If you are a parent, then perhaps you have known the pain that can be encountered when you tread innocently barefoot in the dark as you stride about your abode on one of these, a Lego brick. But you'll see that though these have very sharp corners that can cause considerable pain, it's true, they land pretty much always flat on the table, never once presenting a spike straight upwards to the downward pressing sole of your foot. Whereas any gamer would know that you haven't known pain until you've trodden upon D4 in the night. Yes, these four-sided dice, perfect little pyramids, each will always land on a flat, stable base and present to your downward-pressing foot an agonizing spike. And yet, again, this is as naught next to the capability of the military caltrop. Now, you're the sort of person who's watching one of these videos on this channel, so you probably know what a caltrop is, but have you got one? No. Well, I have, thanks to Stephen at Red Dog Forge, who sent me this piece of cardboard, which I think was rather cunning in the way it folded into the perfect box for housing this box, which was within it, made out of hardboard and gaffer tape, and within that, packed safely with a cork on the end of each spike, a caltrop. Yes, it's about 3 inches tall, which is typical for a caltrop. 2.5 to 3 inches seems to be about the range. And whichever way this lands, it presents the most vicious, vicious, ow, spike. I mean, if you put with some weight your foot on that, ah, ha, ha, this is very sharp. Oh, just the thought of, oh, ow, that would lame you for sure. He chiseled out each prong and then heated it and then on the anvil, bang, 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 each prong into a spike and then bent it into the shape. And a capable blacksmith can knock out quite a few of these in a day. They're not that difficult to make. Now, of course, if you wanted to deny the enemy from using a large part of a battlefield, you could scatter a load of these over it and then his horses wouldn't want to go there. Or some of them would go there and would get lame, or people, the riders, seeing that there were caltrops on the ground, wouldn't go there. You would deny the area to the enemy. But you would need an awful lot of them, wouldn't you? I mean, battlefields are quite big and you can't be really sure of where the enemy's going to go, so you would need massive wagon loads of these and to stand any decent chance of causing many lame opponents. But we are told that these were very effective against horses and chariots particularly. Imagine a heavy chariot. It's got four horses thundering across the plains. Well, for a heavy chariot to be very effective, you need a big flat plain for it to thunder across. And a big flat plain is something that you could scatter lots of these on. And with a four-horse chariot, you only have to get one of these in one of the feet of one of those horses, and the whole chariot will then, you know, be hugely hampered and grind to a rather pathetic halt. These are very effective. And Vegetius, the Roman writer who wrote a manual for the Roman army, he tells us that they were indeed very effective against chariots, and I believe him, and against camels too, because camels have got these big soft-soled feet. You could imagine one of these in a camel's foot, and the camel's really not going to want to play war anymore that day. So the caltrop, nasty. And I have more here, because also answering the call when I put it out was Jason of Wieland Forge. Or was it Wieland or Forge? Anyway, and he also made a very similar caltrop in a pretty similar way. He made another one, this one here, which is just, I mean, these are nasty. These are nasty, really. But this one is just, I look at this and I just think, ah, evil. It's barbed. So if that were in your foot, you couldn't even just hoik it out because the barb would be so painful and rip your flesh. This is really nasty. And it's supposedly a Roman design, but I believe that there were later periods using barbed caltrops as well. And I look at that and I just think, oh, I mean, that's just, oh, no, I'm going to put it away. It's just too nasty. He also made this one, and this is something we'll come to later. This is a modern caltrop. Now, it's It's they're made out of usually circular tubular steel, but he's used, as you can see, square section steel. So he's cut it at an angle, and so we get a sharp-ish, it's not nearly as sharp as that spike, but a sharp-ish, sharp enough spike to puncture the tyre, the pneumatic tyre of a vehicle. So this isn't for your horse or for your camel, this is to go through a tyre, and that's why it's tubular. Because the aim of the game is to deflate the tyre. So you don't want it to pierce and then plug the gap. You want it to pierce and then let the air out pretty rapidly. And there's a little hole drilled here as well. Because you can imagine if the weight of the vehicle presses down on that, these bottom spikes will then perhaps get pressed down into the mud and blocked. And perhaps won't let the air out, or not least let it out very quickly. So with a hole there, the tyre will deflate pretty quickly. So that is a modern use for the caltrop. And they have started to use them in Ukraine, as our Ukrainian correspondent can now attest.
Hello, Lloyd, and all the viewers at the Lindy Bays channel. My name's Joe McDonald, and I run a channel called Big Mac's Battle Blog. You may have seen me before, interviewed by Lloyd. So, Lloyd, what do I have to show you today? Well, as I know you're making a video about caltrops, I thought I'd show you the ones that we've been using over here and that many other units are using up and down the line in Ukraine, although there are a variation in styles. Now, these are the ones that I had commissioned. It's two, sort of a triangle with one slot, so they're slotted together and welded there. And much like the caltrops in ancient times, we use these for stopping cavalry. Although the cavalry we stop is mechanised. We drop them on tracks and roads where we expect enemy vehicles to pass. Usually ones with wheels and not tracked. They're not much good against tracked vehicles. And they pop the tyres, and then we use that opportunity of them being slowed down to hit them with mortar fire or usually FPVs. Now, one of the nice advantages of this sort of design is we couldn't find the right sort of hollow pipe. So we chose this design because as this penetrates and creates a nice wide gap, and the wheel goes forward, the second spike comes up, creating a gap that's, opposed in direction to it, also widening, and then the bottom spike pulls it out. So you normally get, from what we've seen, or what information we've received, about two or three holes in the tyre from it. And that very rapidly drains the air and stops the vehicle within a few metres of it hitting. It can even cause big long rips in the tyre as the different blades rotate and puncture in. So, highly effective. These were cut out with a plasma cutter by a blacksmith shop in central Ukraine. Purely because we needed them quickly at the time, and I was willing to pay a little bit of money, so we had a few hundred of them in 3 days' time and not, them done much cheaper and hand-grinded out in a couple of weeks. Caltrops, still in use in the modern battlefield of today.
Three things I note about this. One is that I wish that Joe would look at the lens and not at his own image in his monitor. Two, it's drone warfare that has brought the caltrop back. Now, you don't have to scatter gazillions of caltrops all over the countryside on the off chance that some enemy blunders into one of them. And then if you then have to advance across that same ground, you've got all the problem of dealing with your own caltrops. No, instead you can be very, very precisely targeted. You can be flying around with a drone, and its camera can pick up an image of, oh, look, it's one enemy vehicle moving down that road. Oh, look, he's going to that corner. He's probably going to have to go around there. Right, we can fly to precisely where we can see that one vehicle and very precisely target. We can put just a few caltrops where we think it's going to go and pop its tyres. Quite an ordinary vehicle as well, just an ordinary car or lorry or the like. Not necessarily a big military vehicle like an armoured car. And that's because of the third thing, which is that this is economic warfare. You might think it's not worth targeting just an ordinary car. Well, if you can put out of action a £5,000 car using a £2,000 first-person kamikaze drone, first-person as in someone's wearing virtual goggles, they're sitting in a bunker somewhere looking at the images projected onto that pair of goggles by a camera, and they're flying it kamikaze-style into a target. It's packed with explosive, boom, destroying both the drone and, all going well, the target. If the kamikaze drone is worth £2,000, you're £3,000 up. And it's now got to the point where it's a war of attrition on hardware a lot of the time. And if you knock out just more and more of the Russian stuff, it becomes harder and harder for them to replace it and eats away at their morale. Now, according to Wikipedia, font of all human knowledge, caltrops were used at the Battle of Carrhae. Now, that would be really interesting because it's precisely the sort of battle at which caltrops would have been really useful. And just in case you don't know, this was the Romans against a load of horse-riding Parthians. And the Parthians kept using their Parthian shots because the Romans would go after the Parthians and the Parthians would run away going twang, 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 twang over their shoulders, and then would just come back and then twang at short ranges, and the Romans would charge them again and they'd run away, twang, twang, twang. So the Romans never got to grips with the Parthians and they got shot to pieces with arrows. But the effective range of horse archery is quite short, so if they'd sent out parties of men with caltrops and scattered them around the place, then the archers would have had a terrible time getting to within a useful range, and then the Romans could have retreated and denied areas of the battlefield. It would have been a wonderful asset to have an awful lot of caltrops at the Battle of Carrhae. So why does Cassius Dio never mention this? Why does Plutarch, why do the two main ancient sources for this battle never mention caltrops if the Romans had them? Because they would have been ever so useful. Do you know, I got a feeling that Wikipedia might actually be wrong. Now, if you were to look up caltrop in a modern textbook, you'll probably find the word common. The opening definition is likely to be something along the lines of the caltrop was a common device used for blah, blah, blah. But were they ever common? I'm not convinced that they ever were. And I do wonder how this they were common idea got so widespread. I imagine, for instance, that some expert who wanted to show other people just how expert he was and how much greater than they he was said something along the lines of, oh, what, you've never heard of them? Oh, the caltrop. We've never heard of them. Oh, I fancy that. Oh, I'm very surprised you haven't heard of the caltrop. Oh, yes, very common. They were very, very common. Oh, listen to me. I'm an expert. I know these things. Oh, yes, they were very common. Oh, the caltrops. Everyone used to use those. Oh, absolutely. Fancy you not knowing that. Oh, yes, very common. And so other people hearing, well, he was an expert and he said they were very common. So they then started saying, oh, yes, they're very common, apparently. Very common, yeah. Oh, yeah, didn't you know that? And then all the modern sources then copy each other because, you know, the experts have started saying this. So they must be right because they're experts. And maybe they weren't actually common. Just think how many caltrops you would need to deny a large area of a battlefield. You need great wagon loads of them, many thousands upon thousands of them. And has any large hoard of caltrops ever been found? Well, of course, I can't prove a negative, can I? It could be that one has been found, but I don't know about it. But I can say that I don't know about one that's been found. But occasionally, a singleton gets found, and they are pictured and mentioned here and there. Vegetius mentions them. Now, Vegetius is writing for Romans who have been in the army. So these are men who have been in the army, and these are so keen on army stuff that they're reading a manual on Roman army stuff. And even in that book, he defines a caltrop. When he talks about how caltrops are useful against chariots, he doesn't then say a chariot was a open-backed, cart-like, two-wheeled... No, he doesn't start defining what a chariot was. He just assumes that the reader knows what a chariot is. He doesn't say, oh, spears were long, pointy sticks. No. But when he mentions caltrops, he then tells the reader, a Roman military man interested in military things, what a caltrop is. Well, why did he do that if they were genuinely very common? My suspicion is it's because they weren't very common. Now, how would you transport them on campaign? Would you have massive wagons of them and people whose job was to wrangle just the caltrops? Or would each man carry, say, six caltrops so that in an emergency you could then, each man would go forward, scatter six caltrops and then rush back to the line and then everyone else would do this and pretty quickly you'd have an awful lot of caltrops out there. But each man then has to collect up six caltrops. Yeah, each man could have been responsible for six caltrops, but I've never come across a single mention of this. We are told all sorts of things about what Roman soldiers had to carry, and one of the things they had to carry that Vegetius does actually mention, it's book 8, by the way, or book 23, if you want to look up the other reference. He does mention them carrying a wooden caltrop for fortifying the camp, and yet other sources tell us of a single spike, often a double-ended spike, that you would use for putting a spike on a rampart for a temporary overnight camp. And each man could carry one of those. We're told about those, but they're not these things. They're not the little metal tetrahedrons. They're not these. So why does Vegetius have to specifically define those ones when he talks about those that are for use against chariots? Pretty good against elephants as well. It's because I think he assumes that his reader is not familiar with that sort of caltrop, even if he does know about the spike for fortifying a camp, because his readers will have been in the army, and one of the things that he will be taught to do is carry your stuff on the march, make camp, fortify the camp, or if you're an officer, oversee other people doing precisely that, making sure that it was done rightly. I don't think they were all that common, you know. In World War I, these were used as well against the Australian Light Horse. I know this because I've read accounts of Australian Light Horsemen collecting them as keepsakes or trading them for more useful things like bullets. This isn't evidence that they were very effective against the Australian Light Horse or that they were used extensively in World War I, just that some Australian Light Horse came across these. I think it was mainly the Turks using them against them. And now, you do think that most of a horse's hoof, right, is, well, it's hoof, and you can literally nail an iron shoe to the bottom of a horse's foot into its hoof without hurting it in the slightest. So if any of this bit went into that part of the foot, it wouldn't harm the horse much at all, you would imagine. Although it'd be a bit of an annoyance stuck on the end of its foot, but it wouldn't cause agony to the beast. It would have to go right into the centre, sensitive part of the foot. But if it did, that would be, yes, extremely painful for the poor horse. So I could see they could be of some use against horses, but against light horsemen in large amounts of countryside roaming about, you would have to be confident of getting them in just the right place, some narrow defile that you might predict that they're going to go through, perhaps. The more I look at these, the more just, horrible I find them. In World War II, the Germans developed a caltrop bomb. It apparently weighed a massive 1,100 pounds. That is a really big bomb, particularly by German standards. They didn't go in for big, heavy bombers that could carry great loads. So 1,100 pounds is a hell of a bomb. And I read in Allied sources, I've come across an American and a British pamphlet, very short reports about these bombs, and I got the impression, they never said this, but I definitely got the impression that they'd never actually got their hands or seen an intact bomb, but had instead gone to the site where one had been dropped and had perhaps found some burst casings and had managed to piece things together and work out that they reckon it was over 4 foot fat, 4 foot thick, this great big bomb hanging on the bottom of a plane that would be dropped, and it had in it an explosive charge. I don't know what the outer shell was made of. Possibly it had a thin steel nose cap and then maybe plywood sides. I don't know. But anyway, this would be burst asunder by the explosive charge, and they estimated 1,000 to 1,500 caltrops scattered over the countryside. These were metal, about 1 millimeter thick sheet metal, and they looked like this. And they were painted in two-color camouflage, brown and green, I think. So that would suggest that they were for use in the European theater to be dropped in the countryside. And what were they for? Well, the The nature, the language used in these pamphlets is very conjectural. For instance, they note that the caltrops, which are of two sizes, 3 inches and 2.5 inches, had an R and an L. They guessed right and left, which works in German, Recht und Links. And they guessed it was something to do with packing them, perhaps in the factory or possibly putting them in the bomb. And there were little holes in them, and they just conjectured that maybe these were for threading them onto strings or poles during manufacture, or during transport, or during the painting process or something. They had little serrations, you'll notice, in the sides. And they're not like the ancient design with just the four thin spikes. Instead, they've got this sheet metal design. But you can see it's the same idea. It's a caltrop. It has a spike on the top. This one has more sharp edges all the way running along down it. And it will sit firmly on three-pronged base. But what were they for? Even that the Allies had to guess at. Again, some sort of aerial denial weapon. If you're dropping it from a plane, that strongly suggests that you'll be dropping it behind enemy lines. So you drop it on a road that he has to use, which will make moving an army more difficult. Possibly it was some sort of airstrip denial weapon. You would drop it on a runway and hope that this would puncture the tires of planes coming to land and the like. But it strikes me that it probably didn't work all that well, which is why it's not a commonly known thing, because they probably didn't make many of them because they didn't work very well and would have been very difficult to, or really awkward load underneath the plane. And you've got to be pretty accurate. You've got to hit that road with a bomb. And World War II bombing was not very accurate for it to be very effective. Now, the charge, I'm guessing, went off in midair, but the pamphlets say nothing on this. But you'd imagine that if it landed at low level, but not actually on the ground, it would then burst and then scatter over a wider area, be a bit more useful. But if you got this on a runway and no one had noticed, then in would come a plane, it would get a punctured tyre perhaps, and one plane does that, and people will then go, oh, it's got this, well, what's this in the tyre? Oh, no, they're all over. You just notice them because runways are flat and clear, so it'd be very easy for a couple of guys with brooms to get the runway working again in next to no time. In the Falklands War in 1982, the Argentinians were quite cunning in the way they managed to keep one of their airfields. There was a landing strip on the Falklands, which they captured, and they kept it going for use throughout most of the conflict. The British had bombed it, put it out of action, but the Argentinians repaired it in a very cunning way, camouflaging it to look as though it was still out of action. They built fake craters on it. And the British aerial photographers delivered images of these, and the British command thought, oh, great, it's out of action, don't have to worry about that. But it was, in fact, still being used. And such was their dismay at the fact that they were hoodwinked in this way, that they then developed, after the Falklands War, a runway denial bomb. It had loads of, it was a cluster munition with loads of little bomblets, and these would be scattered at low level from a tornado all over the runway and would create lots and lots of little craters, which would be much more difficult to repair than just one big one. And in amongst those would be a lot of mines and delayed action bombs, so that people coming in to clear it would then have to be very careful and take their time over it. And perhaps the bulldozers, whatever machines they brought in to clear the way, would be put out of action by these mines. The British stopped making these because cluster munitions and landmines were banned by military treaties, which the British signed up to. But lots of other countries didn't, Russia and the US being notable examples. Anyway, point is that the British went to all that trouble to create this runway denial bomb that had a lot of explosive charges in it. Perhaps because just dropping a load of caltrops on an airfield doesn't actually do all that much. A road, too. Yes, you might puncture the first vehicle that goes along a road, but then people are going to quickly notice, out with a broom, and you just kick them aside. It strikes me that whereas something like this could hide in grass pretty well, as soon as it's on something flat and hard like a road or a runway, it's pretty easy to see. And I don't know about you. Maybe when you walk like this, but I don't. What I do is I pick up a foot and then I swing it forward. As I'm falling forwards, this swings forward and only just clears the ground, and I put that foot down, and then this one comes up and swings forward. So my feet are only just clearing the deck. It's very rare that I will bring my feet 3 inches up, or more than 3 inches up, and then press them straight down. I walk with my feet coming forward and they go ka-fa-dumpf like that. So if there is one of these in front of me, I'm far more likely to kick it out of the way than I am to come down on top of it. But if I'm running on an uneven surface, broken ground, a ploughed field or something like that, then I will have to pick my feet up. And if there's grass growing, I might not see one of these. Yeah, but I can't see the Germans developing a bomb, really, for scattering a load of caltrops on just a field somewhere. It's just not that effective. An archaeological investigation into Jamestown, which today lies on the eastern seaboard of the USA, but of course, back in the day, was just a tiny colony of the English on this vast new continent, a tiny tentative toehold hanging on. Would it survive? Well, they found a caltrop, and some people have from this concluded that caltrops were used to defend these colonists against the Spaniards who might attack at any time, or against the natives, perhaps the wild men who were all about and terribly unknown and terrifying, etc., etc. You can add all the drama you like, but let's not get carried away. They found one caltrop, one example of a type of weapon which, in order to be effective at all, you need to deploy in very large numbers. I think it's possible to get a little bit carried away by such a tiny amount of evidence. Special operations executives, saboteurs, setting Europe ablaze, used these to disable German staff cars and armoured cars and the like, puncturing their tyres. And these have been used more recently, for instance, in strikes. There was a strike at the Caterpillar plant in Peoria, Illinois, in 1995, USA. And these were used to puncture the tyres of vehicles coming in, driven by members of the management, or bringing in workers who were not taking part in the strike. Scabs! Well, unfortunately, there was collateral damage. They managed to disable a school bus, and they hobbled a mailman, a postman, who, yeah, trod on one of these. Ugh. You've got to be careful. These are very indiscriminate. The word caltrop supposedly comes from the old English calca trepa, meaning heel trap, literally. In Swedish, it's foot angel. Which is a little bit weird, but there you go, foot angle, something like that. I don't speak Swedish. Crow's foot is quite common as well, and in a lot of languages, it's a literal translation of crow's foot. For instance, the German for caltrop in that bomb that they dropped in World War II, it was crow's foot. And you can see why a crow's foot might be picked, because you've got the three talons that point forwards and the one that point backwards. So you've got a sort of tripod plus an extra one arrangement, crow's foot. And there are other spiked things that sometimes are referred to as caltrops, but sometimes are more properly named crow's feet, which are spikes. There were boards, for instance. I've seen examples from World War I of a board just covered in these prongs pointing upwards. They look more like crow's feet than they do these things. But caltrop, crow's foot, the general idea, it's a spiky thing you don't want to tread on. And there are also plants named quite commonly using a Latin tribulus. A tribulus is the Latin for caltrop, and Tribulus terrestris, for instance, is the Latin botanical name for a plant that creates tough, spiky seed pods that can serve the function of a caltrop. So there are, if you like, naturally occurring caltrops in Japan. There were some of these that were called, I've got it written down here, makibishi, and these would apparently, they're only little, but they were enough to go through the sole of a sandal and be pretty nasty. And there's the water caltrop as well. They're seeds, which the idea is that they get attached to an animal, and so that animal then acts as a dispersal agent for the seed. So you tread on something, and I've been hurt. Never mind, I'll walk over here, and eventually I'll manage to get it off. And possibly, yes, it hurts your foot for a very long time, but the plant doesn't care. It just cares that its seed has been taken somewhere else. If you want an idea for a fantasy world, you could imagine a plant that's a particularly good caltrop, that has a much bigger naturally occurring seed pod that could be harvested in very large numbers. And so possibly in a fantasy setting, there are some bushes that grow on a particular hillside somewhere. And if you harvest those, then you can fill cartloads with vicious naturally occurring caltrops. It seems that in the late medieval period, the caltrop was an important enough thing to end up being depicted in heraldry. For example, this is the foot angel, or fotangel, or however you say it in Swedish. It's actually a Finnish house. Well, it's in Finland today, but the Swedes, it's a complicated relationship. Essentially, the Swedes used to control Finland, and a lot of the nobility spoke Swedish. So anyway, but you can see that's probably a caltrop being depicted there. And in the medieval arms for the city of Stirling in Scotland, you notice there are these funny shapes on them. It's a bit like a star, but you notice that the you've got three points that are evenly spaced, and there's one at the bottom which isn't. And it has been interpreted as a caltrop. You can imagine those three bottom ones are the bottom sort of tripod and the spike pointing up. Yeah, possibly those are caltrops. And talking of drones, do you have your copy of Game of Drones yet? No? Well, I have my copy because it was sent to me free so that I can tell you about it. And you may see that it looks a little bit well-thumbed. That's because I've been flicking through, looking at the various charts and playing the game, because this is, it's a war game, a solo war game. Just you on your own, you work out how you're going to put your team together, your sapper, your driver, your navigator, and you, and possibly your mascot. And then you have to buy equipment. What sort of car are you going to get? Will it be one that's easy to camouflage, or will you go for being able to carry lots of stuff? And then what drones are you going to buy? Can you afford the drones you need? Are you able to keep your morale up? Are you eating well? Have you fed the mascot? Are you doing well in the war in general? There's a lot to take into account. The weather, for instance. Yes, it may be clear now, but the forecast is for high winds later, so, you know, how's that going to affect things? And where exactly is the enemy, and what have they got? Now, if you are new to wargaming, I wouldn't say that this is necessarily the easiest way to start. It's quite a complicated game. There are 8 pages of charts and tables listing all the various things that the enemy can throw at you and all the things that can go wrong. It took me quite a while the first time I played it just to park the car. But that may sound, hang on, just parking the car? Yes, but you've got to park the car and not be seen by the Russians, and then not be in it if the Russians blow it up with artillery. So there are things to take into account. I bought a camouflage net, but they still spotted me, but they missed with their artillery. Huh. Anyway, about a third of the book is taken up with just details of the war, the way it's being fought now, developments in drone warfare and the like. So there's some general interest stuff in there. The game involves lots of these little counters that you cut out. I put mine through the laminator, and there are lots of maps on which you can keep track of what's going on. And one reason to buy this is to support Big Mac in his efforts in Ukraine. He is the sapper of a drone team that's in action right now. And though, of course, Historic Wings, the publisher, takes a cut, the cut that goes to Big Mac, he then spends on, well, more drones and, well, perhaps even caltrops.